You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Welcome to the Bloomberg P&L Podcast. I'm Paul Sweeney, along with my co-host, Lisa Abramowitz.
Each day, we bring you the most noteworthy and useful interviews for you and your money, whether you're at the grocery store or the trading floor.
Find the Bloomberg P&L Podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts, as well as at Bloomberg.com.
There's a huge focus right now on the fate of small businesses as they're hard hit by the shutdowns from the coronavirus pandemic. Someone who is very clued in to exactly how these businesses operate and how they can survive and thrive going forward is Jim McKelvey, co-founder of Square, that incredibly popular payment system, electronic payment system used by many small businesses. Also the author of a new book, The Innovation Stack, Building an Unbeatable Business, One Crazy Idea at a Time. He is a former glassblower who ended up founding one of the preeminent mobile online payment systems. Jim, thank you so much for being with us today. I want to just start with, just anecdotally, given your conversations with small businesses, how hard hit have they been from this whole episode?
Oh my God, Lisa, they've been tremendously hard hit. And everybody knows it. It's, but nobody knows the extent of it. We are watching some businesses close. We're watching employees in panics. It's bad. And I'm actually still in the art world, and I still run a small studio, and my staff was terrified because we had to shut down.
So why is this time different than other times when you talk about financial downturns?
So this is the first time there's been a voluntary shutdown of a healthy economy. So I'm also a director of the St. Louis Federal Reserve, and so I get to see the economic data almost in real time. And we had a very healthy economy going in, and we elected to voluntarily close down the economy to solve a medical problem. This is different than most recessions. Most recessions just happen because there's some structural problem in the economy. There was none in this case. What happened was we had this medical emergency, and to fight the disease, we had to close the economy. But it's different.
So yes, you do run an art studio and you are a glassblower, I believe, based on your bio. Yet you did also co-found Square, which is one of the key technological advances for a lot of small businesses. And I'm just wondering, the role of tech at this moment when so much business is going online, how are you seeing this as a sort of transformative moment for small businesses in their relationship with their tech infrastructure?
Well, they're super dependent on the tech infrastructure. As a matter of fact, Square has been rolling out new products almost every day to help small businesses adapt. And we're putting new products in their hands, probably one a week now, allowing restaurants to turn to delivery and pickup, making our software free for companies that need it. And basically, look, this in some ways helps companies that have modernized their processes to use electronic payments, to use electronic record keeping, to use electronic meetings, to use distributed workforces. And it's forcing a lot of other companies to get with the program.
Going forward, I'm just wondering, do you expect a lot of these smaller businesses to go out of business completely? Or do you think that there'll just be a sort of transformation as far as weeding out the most successful ones?
Well, I mean, there's certainly going to be a winnowing down of companies that were not well prepared for this. But the real tragedy is that there were a lot of healthy businesses that are getting caught in it. The government's trying to step in. One of my great concerns is that the government is doing a lot of their aid through sort of antiquated paper-based systems, and it's not going to get the money to the people that need it and the businesses that need it fast enough. So At Square, we're working diligently to try to give them the tools for instantaneous or near real-time action if the government chooses to do that.
Wait, so in other words, you're working with the government right now to try to make these payments electronic?
Yes. So Jack sent a tweet about this a couple weeks ago, but basically our whole company stands ready to give whatever aid we can because we've had the electronic rails working for several years and they work with millions of businesses. And scaling from millions to tens of millions or hundreds of millions is not as difficult as scaling from nothing to, you know, project number one.
Jim McKelvey, thank you so much for being with us and for sharing your insights. Jim McKelvey is co-founder of Square, based in St. Louis, author of The Innovation Stack, Building an Unbeatable Business, One Crazy Idea at a Time, a new book that's out. He also is a glassblower, which I really love as somebody who used to do sculpture a long time ago. One of the key questions for markets going forward is whether inflation will actually start to pick up this time. Typically in the past, the idea has been theoretically when governments print money that leads to inflation. It didn't happen in 2009. People are expecting it not to happen again. But are they wrong? Maura Murphy joining us now, Vice President and Portfolio Manager at Loomis Sayles, which oversees nearly $300 billion and is based in Boston. Maura, this to me is one of the most important debates at a time when people are basically shrugging off the concept of inflation going forward, even as governments and central banks unleash some of the biggest financial packages ever to hit markets. Do you think this time is different than the 2008-2009 financial crisis and that this actually will spur inflation?
Hi, Lisa. Thanks for having me. You know, it's certainly different this time in that the pace and the size that the Fed is issuing and buying right now is drastically different than any of the other QEs we've ever seen. They're really doing this at what I'd call a sprint pace. And we need to get ourselves into this marathon mindset rather than the sprint we've been in, because they need, as you see this week, they're already starting to taper the pace of their purchases, and we'll see how the market responds to that. So far, as you mentioned, the break-evens are off their lows, which suggests that the market is no longer pricing that real fear of deflation or disinflationary risk, but we're still well off the levels of being afraid of inflation to come. I think the thing to watch that'll be key to see if we do get inflation this time with all the easing is what happens with the dollar. We need to watch for that excess dollar liquidity in the market. And given the amount that we've seen with increased swap lines from the Fed, a weaker dollar would finally perhaps give us that impetus for inflation pressure. But I think that's a lot further down the line. And right now we need to be focused on the pace of the Fed buying.
All right. So I guess inflation is sort of a hard concept to get your mind around because there are a lot of different components to it. And there are a lot of potential scenarios in terms of whether the financial package from the Fed continues to accelerate or if it does slow down, as you talked about. There is a much more concrete issue of bond yields. And we're looking right now at 10-year yields at 0.75%. And you're seeing people expect that rate to actually go down over time, even as the U.S. prints unprecedented amounts of these securities. At what point will that increase in supply lead to higher yields?
That's the ultimate question here, right, is timing on all of this. And I think, unfortunately, we still have too many unknowns to really have a good sense of when that actually might occur. The Fed is talking about issuing T-bills right now for supply to pay for this stimulus, but eventually they may need to issue on the back end of the curve, which I don't think we have a lot of natural demand there right now with levels as low as you mentioned, because people are starting to step into some of the new IG issuance rather than stay in the safe haven treasury assets. But volatility remains really high in this asset class. The Fed has improved liquidity, but vol is still there. And so I think, you know, given that, we're likely to see bigger moves intraday, and the range of yields that we're going to be in will likely be wider than we've been used to. So when we used to trade in a range of 20 to 30 basis points on 10 or 30-year yields, now I think that range could be a lot wider while we try to figure out where the right level is based on the supply that's coming and based on the buying that's happening.
The volatility has pretty significant consequences, not only for the treasury market, but also for credit. And I'm wondering what this does for investment grade bonds, even as they're backstopped by the Federal Reserve, given the fact that they're more sensitive than ever to the fluctuations in the volatility and treasury yields.
Yeah, one of the patterns we've seen over the last week is that all of this new IG issuance that's come to market, you have deals that are highly oversubscribed. I'd liken it to all of us right now rushing to get that online order. We all wake up early and we're trying to, you know, secure that online delivery for our groceries every day. And
are you actually succeeding, by the way? Are you?
No, it's so hard, isn't it?
I've failed every single day. I actually have to go out, get geared up in my hazmat suit and go to the grocery store. But carry on, please.
Yeah. So, you know, if we think of it like that, we have this rush for everyone going to the same space right now, because that's where the Fed is supporting. So, you know, that old adage of don't fight the Fed persists here. So you want to be in IG, and that demand for these high quality large deals is really persisting. And I think that will continue. And we've only probably just seen the start of that. And I think to strengthen the secondary will be the next order of operations after all of this new issuance.
So it sounds like you're overweight investment grade. Is that right?
Yeah, we're constructive on the new issuance here, and we like the level of yields after the backup. And I think given the natural buyer in the Fed, it's a place we definitely like and will be adding to.
What about high yield?
It's a little bit harder to source high yield paper right now.
Really?
We're seeing that IG with the excess supply is a little bit easier for us to be buying right now. In high yield, I'm just not sure we have a good sense yet, given the unknowns with the recovery of, you know, how long will this last?
Wait.
How fast can companies really resume normal operations, and how big and how, you know, what's the magnitude of this recession? And not knowing those unknowns, it's hard to really assess recovery values in high yield companies. And so I guess we're just not ready to say that the bounce is real here yet. So we're not adding to the riskier sectors at the moment.
That's really compelling to me. You said it's difficult to source paper. In other words, has the dramatic move that we've seen been largely on paper, and nobody really wants to solidify their losses by actually selling the underlying bonds? Is that what you're saying?
Liquidity is definitely improving across the board, across most markets, but I think it's perhaps not necessarily people stepping in to buy yet in large size. This sell-off has happened very quickly. I think, you know, less than a month, or just about a month, is how long it took for us to hit the bottoms here, if we did hit the bottom. And that's, you know, the fastest pace we've seen in a long time. Back in 87, it took about 75 days for the peak to trough to occur. And this time it took less than 30. So given that it just happened so quickly, I'd be shocked if there isn't more downside to come. And I think in light of that, it's unwise to be stepping into risk here.
Maura Murphy, thank you so much for being with us. Maura Murphy, Vice President and Portfolio Manager at Loomis Sales, with almost $300 billion under management, based in Boston. I'm Lisa Abramowitz. My co-host and colleague, Paul Sweeney, off today from New York. This is Bloomberg Markets.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum, powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
There's a key question in the transformation of the U.S. economy right now that's going on in the heels of the coronavirus, and that is, what is the state of the consumer? Will they be able to maintain the recovery that we saw that will have to happen yet again and may not happen yet again for another couple of years. Joining us now is David Kudla, Chief Executive Officer and Chief Investment Strategist at Mainstay Capital Management. David, this has been a sort of key talking point for years, that the American consumer is very strong. Right now, we are seeing an absolute demolition in confidence among American consumers. How pivotal are they in the recovery from this period of time that we're looking at?
It'll be very pivotal. Hi, Lisa. The consumer is two-thirds of the U.S. economy, and how the consumer comes out of this in terms of their purchasing habits, the consumer sentiment, consumer confidence, how soon consumers are willing to re-engage the economy, how unemployment affects their behavior coming out of this, how pay cuts, because some of the, there are different impacts on different parts of or different demographics across the U.S. We have some that are going to be unemployed for a certain period of time, and the fiscal stimulus package is addressing some of that in a meaningful way. There are others that are going to just have haircuts in their pay. A lot in the automotive industry here in Michigan have 20% pay deferrals. Or pay cuts, just straight pay cuts that will go on for months. And so that's going to be affecting, consumer discretionary activity. So it's yet to be seen. So much of this is unknown, but it will be key in how the consumer behaves coming, out of or on the other side of the coronavirus restart of the economy.
Yeah, I was looking at a story out of the Financial Times, a survey that they conducted, and it came out today, that nearly three quarters of Americans say the coronavirus pandemic has reduced their family's income. Nearly a quarter said their household income had been cut very significantly, according to this poll. And you're very much at the epicenter of that when you look at the auto industry in Detroit and how much it's just come to a complete halt. How much long-term damage will that do? I mean, that's sort of a key question I'm wondering. How quickly can people revive, not just from a balance sheet perspective, but from a confidence perspective? Is there any kind of historical precedent?
I don't know that there is. This is the first recession that's been brought on by a pandemic, that's been brought on by any kind of disease or virus. So it's unknown in that regard. We have some predictability in that, we came into this with an economy on pretty good footing in terms of being at 50-year unemployment. We had rising wages. We had a relatively strong consumer coming into this, and then the economy didn't shut down or slow down under normal business conditions or a normal business cycle. It was an artificial restraint. The government actually shut down the economy, and we're going to fire it back up. But there's some natural things or natural or human factors that have to happen for that to reoccur. So there are a lot of unknowns in that.
As an investor, how do you trade around this?
Well, I think for now, I think that, these last 2 days, there is a lot of optimism about, what we saw over the weekend in New York City, the improvement of the last several days in Europe, specifically in France, in Spain, in Italy. And so there's confidence about the number of new cases slowing. But we know that we have a long way to go here, and the economic impacts are still to be realized. So I think that investors need to be careful about thinking that this is behind us. And we think that it's still important to have, some defensive posturing in place, some hedges in place in your portfolio, because there's still volatility ahead. We've still got some pretty bad economic numbers to come out, and first quarter earnings and even second quarter earnings that are going to be pretty abysmal.
So do you think that you'd be selling this rally, and that you expect the U.S. equity markets to test new lows?
I don't know if we'll test new lows, but I think we've certainly got a downdraft, more of a downdraft from some point here. I don't know how much further this rally can go. We're seeing it fade a little bit as we get into trading today. Very strong rally yesterday. Futures were strong again this morning. Started to fade a little bit. Come and go today through trading this morning. But, we see, we're in a, what we're calling right now, an event-driven bear market, not a a secular bear market, not a, you know, we don't think that this is a morphs into an 08, 09 type of bear market, that this is still just an event-driven bear market that will just last a few short months and not a couple of years or a year or longer. We think that we're coming out of this, and by the end of the year, the economy and stock market will be on pretty good footing again. That's yet to be seen, but that's our forecast right now.
The economy and the stock market are two very different things, and there's a feeling that the stock market might recover, but the economy, the economic hit, very few people at this point are putting conviction behind a V-shaped recovery in the economy. What gives you confidence that this will just be a couple of months and then all those jobs will come back?
I guess it really comes down to, and we don't know, right? It comes down to how long the social distancing needs to go on, how the data keeps coming in relative to the number of new cases, and then what we talked about earlier on how the consumers reengage the economy, how people get back to work, continuation of. Or the continuation of unemployment for a period of time. The longer it goes, the more businesses that go out of business, the more people that are suffering that much longer, makes it that much harder to restart the economy and starts to manifest into longer term effects. That's the risk. So the sooner we restart the economy, and I'm not suggesting we do that, it's got to be health and safety first, but the sooner we restart the economy, the less the effects will be. If you look at China as a model, and as much as we believe the data and the recovery, but there's measurements that we're taking that are being taken to see that what the real recovery rate is there and how much factories are actually running and so forth. But they really did have somewhat of a V-shaped recovery in a matter of a few months from the time they went down to come back up. They're not running at full production now. It's questionable as to what markets they can ship to. But you know, there's a model where it all happened literally in a few months.
Yeah. David Kudla, thank you so much for being with us. David Kudla, Chief Executive Officer and Chief Investment Strategist at Mainstay Capital Management, with nearly $3 billion, joining us from Michigan. There's a question right now about the progress of the coronavirus and some of the measures put in place to limit its spread in Europe. They appear to be working. However, we did see an increase in the number of deaths in Spain. And there is a question right now around the leadership of the United Kingdom, as Boris Johnson, the prime minister, is still in the hospital in an intensive care unit being treated for the coronavirus. For some insight on what we should take away from this episode, let's bring in Therese Raphael, Bloomberg Opinion Editor, covering European politics and economics. Therese, of course, our thoughts are with Boris Johnson, hoping that he does recover from the virus. On a bigger level, though, is there anything that we can take away in terms of the leadership of the United Kingdom throughout this epidemic, as well as beyond, and what the future brings in terms of Boris Johnson's government?
Well, the UK does not, like the US, have a vice president or vice prime minister role. There's no constitutionally designated number two. At present, Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab, a cabinet member and one-time rival to Boris Johnson, has been designated as his stand-in for day-to-day policy meetings. And the cabinet says it's taking decisions by consensus. Now, that can continue for a while. Should Johnson become seriously incapacitated, should he resign, then it's a different process. The cabinet would then choose a member to recommend to the Queen to become prime minister. There's no acting prime ministerial role in the UK constitution. They would simply become prime minister. But I think that's sort of getting ahead of ourselves. Johnson, the news out this afternoon, is in good spirits and stable. He's not on a ventilator, as you said in your introduction. So the hope is that he will be able to return to full work. Whether that will happen in a few days or much further into the future isn't clear.
Therese, forgive me for being, I don't want to say cynical, but cynical. We got communication out of the United Kingdom that Boris Johnson was totally fine. They were mild symptoms. Then we got information that he was just brought to the hospital for a precautionary check. It was just a precautionary measure. Stop getting your nose all out of joint about it. It's no big deal. Then we hear he's in the ICU, but he's not in a ventilator. He's fine. Everything's copacetic. Is there a trust issue here, or you know, is this just sort of a protocol for a leader of a nation?
Yeah, I mean, I wish I could answer that with any great certainty. There are moments when it has felt a little bit, like watching the old Soviet leaders and wondering what's happening. I think what we have to bear in mind is that this virus operates in sort of strange and mysterious ways. There are cases where a COVID-19 sufferer will be experiencing fairly moderate symptoms that persist, and within hours it gets much worse. So it may be that that Downing Street was putting a positive spin on things, and it may also be that the Prime Minister, who we know, we know from his biographer that he doesn't believe in illness. He tends to work through illnesses. He doesn't really tolerate it in his staff. That he may have just been pushing himself, not being quite, as careful about, looking after himself and resting, and things might have deteriorated quite quickly. I think we're not going to know that for a while. The Downing Street is going out of its way right now to say that they are being transparent. They're updating the media regularly. But that's a legitimate question, and many here are asking it.
Just shifting gears to the continent of Europe, there is some talk about reopening parts of certain economies as the virus does appear to be plateauing when it comes to the count of deaths and new cases in certain hotspots. I'm wondering what the latest is on that.
Well, the epidemiological curve is at a different place, or let's put it this way, different countries are on a different place on that curve. And those that have taken earlier measures, or whose death rates and infection rates are slowing, are now starting to contemplate loosening those measures. But it's a very finely balanced decision, because there is no vaccine, as we know. There won't be a vaccine most likely for a while, and there's always a risk that in loosening controls, you see another surge of infections, and that it then becomes harder, as a team that advises Boris Johnson keeps saying, it becomes harder to reimpose those controls after people sort of, get a taste of having some freedom. So I think we're likely to see this progressing by fits and starts. Perhaps some schools will reopen, or certain, still fairly essential businesses will be allowed to operate, but people will still be encouraged to work from home and that sort of thing. There's also discussion of issuing immunity passports. So those who have tested positive in the past, have had COVID-19, or who antibody tests show have had it even if they didn't experience symptoms, would be given some kind of certification so that they could use public transport, return to work, and communicate to anyone that they are not infectious. But that depends on getting the disease being a sort of one and done, rather than something that can you can be reinfected with in a short period afterwards.
Therese Raphael, we are all living in a science fiction novel. Therese Raphael, Bloomberg opinion editor covering European politics and economics. It does feel like it is a scene out of some sort of surreal science fiction when everybody is being tested for their immunological defense mechanisms to this virus going forward.
Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg P&L podcast. You can subscribe and listen to interviews at Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast platform you prefer. I'm Paul Sweeney. I'm on Twitter at PT Sweeney.
I'm Lisa Abramowitz. I'm on Twitter at Lisa Abramowitz 1. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcasts.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV+.